From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the program, we'll learn about a unique effort to connect artists with the Affordable Care Act. The American Medical Association thinks healthcare reform should include reforming medical school.
Let's help fund some institutions to look at innovative changes in how we educate our young men and women who are going to be our physicians as we age.
We'll speak with filmmaker and Milwaukee native George Tillman Jr. And Elizabeth Uhlberg's new young adult novel owes a debt of gratitude to the classic film When Harry Met Sally.
And I know that it's so dated with the fashion, but it's such a timeless story. So I'm hoping, if anything, this will get kids to watch that movie.
Lake Effect comes your way next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We have a lot of artists and musicians on this show talking about the things they paint or sculpt or the music they write. Some of them even talk about the challenges of being an artist from a business standpoint. But what's rarely discussed are some of the minutiae of being on your own as a working artist. Like, what do you do if you get sick? Some artists are fortunate to be married to someone with health insurance coverage. Others have to fend for themselves. But a unique effort in Milwaukee is underway to reach out to the artist community and better connect it with the emerging healthcare marketplace under the Affordable Care Act. Tammy Clendenning is an economic development specialist for the Small Business Administration's Wisconsin District in Milwaukee. Catherine Leonis is a health insurance specialist with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for the Federal Department of Health and Human Services in Chicago. They joined Bonnie North in the studio recently, and Leonis explained how the project developed.
Well, I think a lot of them are very interested in what's available to them because they never thought it was achievable to get health insurance coverage. So I think a lot of questions around, you know, I'm a small business or I've got, you know, I'm a sole proprietor. I didn't really think of myself as a business, as an artist. And now I can access something that is much cheaper than what they were going to access without the marketplace.
So are you seeing a lot of artists rushing to take advantage of this once they find out that they can?
Well, I think we're seeing the beginnings of that. As we look at our numbers for enrollment, we're seeing a lot more people enroll. So I have to guess that some of our outreach efforts to the artist community are beginning to work.
What kind of outreach are you doing that might differ from, say, other populations that you're trying to reach?
Well, since they're artists and artisans, what we're trying to do is we've done a webinar for them to try to make sure that they get the information in a timely way and that they don't have to travel somewhere and incur that expense and to make it as easy as possible to get the information to them. So we'll host a series of those over the coming months and try to get them involved.
Okay. Well, Tammy, it's a perfect chance to bring you in now. Are artists surprised to find that they really should consider themselves as a sole proprietor, as a small business?
You know, I think that's definitely been what we have found. And the new law and the way that the insurance is set up, it's a great opportunity for the artist community to be able to have health insurance now that they might not have had access to in the past.
And do you find that once they're there for health insurance, they're looking to you and to the agency for perhaps other things they didn't think they were qualified for as well, perhaps loans or that sort of thing?
Certainly. There's really three different components to the Small Business Administration, and we're finding that the artists really in the past hadn't thought that they would qualify for some of the programs, but very specifically the business counseling that's available it's free of charge to small businesses or to sole proprietors, and that can help with a whole host of business topics that they have, whether that be marketing or accounting or establishing a business plan or seeking access to capital. And that's, speaking of capital, that is probably the largest part of our program is the access to capital programs. We, as the Small Business Administration, provide a guarantee to lenders so that they will make loans to small businesses. And there's a whole host of different programs that we have available specifically for artists and other businesses as well.
Well, the kinds of things I would think for artists is that because they are often the product that they are selling and that they're, you know, that they're basing the business on, it's hard to show a traditional lender collateral. Is that a problem that you find that you have programs in place to help with?
Well, and that is probably one of the largest reasons that lenders will look for an SBA guarantee is for a lack of collateral. Specifically on loans under $25,000, there isn't a requirement for a specific amount of collateral. So, and that's probably the majority of the loan size that we find with some of the artists and the artisan communities. In addition, there are other programs that go up to $150,000 and even higher than that as well. But I think that probably with the community that we're talking about, those loans are the most important. And right now, through the SBA, there is no fees associated with those loans. So it's really a great time for artists and the artisan community to take advantage of those programs.
Now, is this the first time that HHS and SBA have partnered to reach a particular population?
Yes, I think it is. I think we're unique here in Milwaukee and in the area to be creating this partnership. I don't know of any others that are happening this way to targeting the artisan community. And we've had some great success between Musicians Union has been really, really, really helpful in getting the word out to their folks. And I know they're signing up as well as working with the Small Business Administration to reach other artists through other artisan organizations.
How long has it been going on? The partnership hasn't been together that long, has it?
I would say about 6 months.
Okay, so really not that long.
Not that long.
Particularly in government work. You
exactly.
Know, that's
it's
a very
short time in government work. And part of the Affordable Care Act created the partnership was that with the Small Business Exchange or Marketplace, so to speak, the shop, that the SBA was brought in as part of knowing business. And so we leveraged their communications channels with businesses and small businesses to access them and help them understand what the Small Business Options program is so that they can get access to the healthcare marketplace as well. And what we're finding out is a lot of the artisans are more sole proprietors than small businesses. So they're going on the regular marketplace rather than the small business marketplace. But the SBA certainly has the expertise in communicating with business in general. So it's been great to be able to leverage that.
And what we find too is perhaps right now some of them are sole proprietorships, but many of them that we speak with have dreams of becoming larger. And so it gives them an opportunity to know what's available to them as they continue to grow as well, or as they maybe change the corporate structure of their business. So it's been a very good partnership so far.
Do you hope that the rest of the country kind of takes a look at what you're doing here in Milwaukee and says, wait a minute, maybe we can do this too?
Actually, I know they already are.
Oh, that's good.
I know that the way our offices are structured, there's 10 regional offices. And as we talk about what's working, this is one of the highlights nationally, this partnership here in Milwaukee and in the area with the artisan community.
And from our perspective as well, it's been great to have this partnership available because for really the small business community as a whole, there's always a number of questions that come up, and we have a direct line in to find answers for them. So whether that's in the artisan or the musician community or the small business community as a whole, it's really nice to have that direct link to get information for them.
Well, let's talk a little bit of specifics, if you would. What kinds of questions? If, you know, I'm an artist, I both am interested in getting my health insurance organized and I'm interested in possibly, say, getting a small loan to increase production of whatever I'm doing. What do I do? Where do I go? What is the best approach?
Well, I think there's probably one of the best approaches is to contact the Small Business Administration and they can help with both. And you'll still have to access two doors, but then you'll go on to the healthcare.gov website, and that's where you'll look to shop for plans and begin to decide if you're a sole proprietor, decide what works for you, and maybe what premium tax credits are available to you.
Now, can the SBA help with that? Can you help determine that for somebody?
We can certainly put them in touch with the right places to go. We can offer some advice, but there are some of the different governmental agencies, such as the IRS.gov or the Health and Human Services website. So we really provide more opportunity or referrals for the places to go to get the correct information.
Sort of a portal.
Yes,
for
exactly.
People to go through.
That's exactly. We can answer some basic questions, but really we try to get them to the people who can give them the most accurate information.
And here in Milwaukee, one of the really nice bonuses is that the 211 line that is operated by by impact is really playing a key role in providing information. So if you call 211, they will tell you where you can find local help. So who can actually sit down with you and fill out the application and answer all of your questions. So it's a great resource here in Milwaukee. And
I didn't even know it existed.
It does exist. Just dial 211 for information, and they can send you all sorts of services. But they will also tell you where you can fill out applications and who can help you do it.
Have you found that there are general questions that people keep asking over and over? What are people most curious about?
A lot of what we have found is for some of the smaller businesses, trying to determine exactly whether they would be an appropriate candidate for SHOP or whether they would be more an appropriate candidate to go onto the regular individual marketplace. That's probably been a lot of it. Obviously, very special individual circumstances. One of the other things that we've had a lot of questions about is the tax credits and how those work. And then obviously now with the changes that came out last week in terms of the employer shared responsibility, who is obligated by which dates and how does that work? That tends to be where we find the majority of the questions.
And Catherine?
I think the questions we're receiving are really centered around where can I find local help? How do I look at plans and shop for plans? Can I do it without actually signing up for anything? And yes, you can. And then I think finally, what's affordable for me? And helping people understand the different affordability plans. There's different what we would call metal levels to really look at what's my cost going to be out of pocket and helping people understand what those costs are going to be. And what is a lot of people coming onto the marketplace have never had insurance. So even understanding how to use insurance once you get insurance, those are the kinds of questions we're getting.
Do you find that, a lot of musicians and certainly probably sole business proprietors in general, you don't really know what your income is going to be for the year. You hope. You have a projection of what you think it's going to be. But if you're a musician, it depends on the gigs. It depends on all kinds of things. Does that complicate things for artists and artisans?
I think it is. It does complicate things in terms of projections. But the nice thing is that there's new functionality on the website that you can update based on, your earnings throughout the year. So you can update it and it'll adjust what your premium tax credits were. Because as you may know, the premium tax credits can be paid directly from the federal government, if you're eligible, to the insurer to help defray the costs of your premiums. So if, say, I thought I was going to make $50,000 and I'm not, I can go in and change it. It'll recalculate my subsidy. Say I made $30,000. It would recalculate. It would give me more of a subsidy. And then I'll take care of the finalization at the end of the tax year. Or if I'm getting too much subsidy, then it'll take it away. And then I won't be liable for that money at the end of the tax year. So I think that's a big thing for artisans, especially whose income fluctuates.
As we're wrapping up today, is there one thing that you'd like people listening today to take away from our conversation, to make sure that they know, what you offer?
For the Small Business Administration, what we would really want the audience to know is that we are here as a resource for small business. Our purpose is to help, aid, and counsel small businesses, and certainly we would welcome any questions or information that they would need.
And a small business doesn't have to mean somebody making a widget.
That's absolutely correct.
And Catherine from HHS?
I think the most important point that people need to remember is that healthcare is important and that there is help available for them to access quality healthcare and that they just need to get online and start to look.
And ask the questions.
And ask the questions.
Well, Catherine and Tammy, I can't thank you both enough for stopping in today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tammy Clendenning is an economic development specialist for the Small Business Administration in Milwaukee. Catherine Leonis is a health insurance specialist for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in the Department of Health and Human Services. They spoke with Bonnie North. The American Medical Association looks at change that extends beyond the cost of care. We'll learn more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. As we discussed before the break, the Affordable Care Act includes the creation of health exchanges designed to allow uninsured and underinsured Americans to have greater access to affordable care. But that road has not yet been a smooth one, and questions linger for many affected by the changes. The president of the largest association of doctors in the country took on the issue of health care reform and more when she was in Milwaukee recently. The American Medical Association has been a backer of the Affordable Care Act. Dr. Artis Hovind met with members of the Medical Society of Milwaukee County in January. She talked with us about the areas the AMA hears about most often.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here this morning.
When you go to a place like Milwaukee and speak to, you know, both your members and even members of the public at large, what is the key point you're hearing from people and what is the key message that you try to bring to them?
Well, thank you for that question, because people are very concerned about their health care. What's going to happen in this country? Health system reform. What does it mean for me? What does it mean for my family? Will I be able to keep my doctor? Will I have to change where I get my health care? So many of the issues around the continuity of care, how I'm going to receive it, who's going to be providing it for me, and can I get care? So I think the American Medical Association, as it's moved forward in its work around the Affordable Care Act, around many of the regulatory issues in the ACA, have dealt with many of those issues and trying to make sure that as we reach out and cover more uninsured patients, that in fact the way they get their health care is being delivered appropriately, that it meets the needs of the patients and the communities in which they live. And then also as we move forward, we talk about three major areas of work that the AMA is involved in: improving health outcomes, physician satisfaction and practice stability, and medical education.
Well, let's talk about each of those areas. I think the issue with outcomes maybe has been a little overlooked. I mean, there's this very loud debate in this country over healthcare reform, even as components have been going into place. But as that national debate goes on, there are still some significant public health issues that persist, especially in a place like Milwaukee. We hear in this community about things like infant mortality and a rise in the HIV rate. Regardless of who's paying for healthcare, has there been some loss of focus on health outcomes in this country?
I think we've always talked about health outcomes, but we've never really moved the dial in a meaningful way. And at the American Medical Association, that's what we want to start doing. And what we have decided to do is take on two long-term healthcare issues. One is hypertension, high blood pressure. The other is diabetes. And if you look at the morbidity and the mortality in this country associated with that, the sickness, the loss of life, the poor quality of life around those two illnesses, we have something we need to make changes on, and we are going to move in that direction.
I kind of envision a Venn diagram of all the various health outcome issues, and I would imagine that the overlap is pretty strong when it comes to both diabetes and hypertension.
When we talk about population health in this country, it's a language and a conversation which we need to be having more of. And so this is our opportunity to move forward. People say, well, why should the American Medical Association be concerned about health outcomes? We have in this country a great public health system. We've got all sorts of entities which deal with it. But why the AMA? Well, doctors see these patients every day. All of us, no matter what the specialty is, will see patients with high blood pressure and diabetes walking through their clinics and their operating rooms. We need to be a part of the equation.
Well, and so what part of the equation do you see the AMA filling?
Well, first off, let me talk about diabetes. We have partnered now with the YMCAs throughout the country through their work on the diabetes prevention program, looking at evidence-based studies that show that if you get individuals with prediabetes referred to YMCAs, where they take on a very strict protocol of exercise and diet with feedback loops to the healthcare provider, that you can cut the risks of diabetes significantly. So partnering in collaboratives is what we are going to do. We cannot do that alone. It's going to take communities. It's going to take doctors in communities and all healthcare providers in communities to, in fact, make this happen appropriately.
And then as far as hypertension goes?
For hypertension, we're partnering with folks at the NIH, some very brilliant people working around control of hypertension. Now, let me give you some statistics. About 30 million people in this country who have healthcare access have poorly controlled hypertension. So why is that? We know how to make the diagnosis. We know how to treat it. What is wrong? Why are these folks not getting their blood pressure controlled? Because poorly controlled blood pressure is associated with lots of complications. So we're going to figure this out, and we're going to be working with these people, putting on pilot studies, trying to figure out what works in communities, what doesn't. And I think it's going to be more than just the doctors and the doctor's offices. We're going to find that it's going to take the community working together to alleviate this problem.
You talked about NIH, and that's when talk about medical research comes in. Do we fund medical research at a high enough level in this country?
Probably not. We've worried about that for some years with changes in financing, the whole issue of costs. We need to look at that critically in the future and continue to do so.
Let's talk about some of the other areas the AMA is especially interested in. Is there an issue with professional satisfaction among doctors at this point in time?
As I've gone around the country and as many of us have learned over the last years and as we have listened to our colleagues out there, this feeling of not being empowered to do what you want to do as a physician, this dissatisfaction with what's happening in the care community, destabilization of practices around financing, for example, Medicare funding, and all the unknowns out there, what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act and so forth and so on. And so when you find out that doctors won't recommend to their children that they become physicians, there's a problem, and we've identified that. We started about a little over a year and a half. We did a study with the RAND Corporation looking at physician satisfaction and practice stability in six states, 30 practices, large ones, little ones, multi-specialty, single specialty. We learned some very important things. Not too surprising, but when you saw it in print and you understood what it meant, it was very sobering. Number one, the most important thing that makes physicians dissatisfied is when anything gets in the way of them being able to provide the highest quality health care that they can. And there are a lot of things that get in the way. Regulatory, administrative, you name it. The other one that bothers them and dissatisfies them is the whole issue around the electronic health record. We had heard and we'd all experienced troubles, but we did not understand the impact of how the electronic health record was impacting physician practices, how much time they had to spend away from the patient, systems that didn't work, they were not interoperative, they didn't talk to each other, it didn't solve the problem, and in fact may not have improved the care that they were delivering. However, we like technology, so we have to fix this one. So what this has done is empowered us now to go forward with the regulatory people, with the federal government, with the administration of this country, and with vendors to talk about we've got to fix this problem because simply sticking a doctor in front of a computer and making them check all the boxes isn't going to improve the quality of healthcare.
In a way, have we as a society kind of inserted a wedge between the doctors and the patient community?
Very much so. When I have to sit there in the interface is the computer screen, not the space between me and my patient. That's a problem. And for many of us, what we do is we do the care, scribble a few notes at the end of the day, go back in, and 2, 3, 4 hours later have inputted all the data into the computer. That's not the way to practice medicine.
Another one of the key priorities the AMA has identified is changing the way medical education takes place. What is wrong with the system that has produced doctors in this country for decades?
Well, we've been teaching and training under the Flexnerian way, which was good 100 years ago, which is the way I was trained in medical school. But what we've realized is that we're putting physicians out there now, some of whom may not be as competent as we would like, number one. Number two, they do not understand the various issues around the delivery of care. By that, I mean the business aspects of it. How do you do this? How do you accomplish that? And then, you know, we teach them hospital-based care, which is where we got most of our training, and most of us get our care as an outpatient now. So those are just a few examples. What we're looking at now, and there's been much discussion for years, but the AMA sort of put its money where its mouth is, we have to change it. Let's help fund some institutions to look at innovative changes in how we educate our young men and women who are going to be our physicians as we age, and looking at some very innovative and very collaborative pieces of work. There are 11 medical schools now involved. This is exciting work.
I suspect, though, no one goes to medical school because they're interested in billing and the economics of medicine. Is that ever going to change, and should we expect it to change?
You're right on that. You know, we take men and women into medical school. They have passion. They're driven to do something that makes a difference, because being a physician is probably one of the most wonderful jobs in the world. And at the end, we turn them out and we've trained them. They know the science. They know what to do, what not to do in that. But we need to make them able to move from the medical environment and their residency training programs into the real world space and continue that passion. So what we want them to be competent, we want to use their time wisely. Perhaps instead of calendar training, we do it competency training. They move through the system them quicker. If they know they want to be a pediatrician, for example, they don't spend months and months in some educational piece of medical school that's probably not going to help them a whole lot at the end of their training. We want to make it better for them. They're more competent. They're happier in their shoes when they leave, and they're going to do a better job.
Much of the healthcare reform debate in this country right now is playing out through anecdotes. Who's been dropped from coverage? How much people are paying? This person is covered when they weren't before because of an underlying condition. How would you assess the state of healthcare reform in this country?
We started with an act, a piece of legislation in 2010, which we all knew was not perfect, but it was the best place to begin the process. When you look at what it addressed with the uninsured, the cost of care, the issue of fragmentation of care, many issues in those particular areas, we knew we had to make a difference. Something had to take place. It's not a perfect piece of legislation, but in fact, as we've begun to move this out, as for example with the exchanges, nobody in their right mind should have believed these would have run perfectly from the get-go. What we need to do is continue to sort of turn the knobs, make the improvements, make the adjustments, recognize where the challenges are, where the problems are, and agree to then solve them in a way to make it better for the patients utilizing the services and getting the care. I am always optimistic about this because I think what we had prior to 2010 in the Affordable Care Act was unacceptable, and in fact, we're moving in a better direction now.
We've been talking about healthcare reform, and there is this sort of ongoing gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands, and it's a debate. Do you see the medical community speaking with one voice in the healthcare reform debate, and does it need to?
It definitely needs to. We need to recognize, though, that there is diversity amongst us, and diversity is good because what it does, it challenges us to come to consensus, and that is the way everything needs to be done in our grand country. The Milwaukee County Medical Society is good evidence of that, what they've been able to do with improving access to health care, their immunization initiative, their patient safety efforts, coming together with one voice, doing things for their community that is very important. Good leadership starts at our community levels because that's where leadership is the toughest. And being able to get people together agreeing that this is the best pathway. You don't go from 0% to 100% buy-in, and you have to work at it. And that's where good leadership comes into play. But the Milwaukee County Medical Society has, in fact, done that in a very remarkable way.
Well, Dr. Artis Hovind, thank you so much. Best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Artis Hovind is the president of the American Medical Association, which has around 217,000 members around the country. She was in Wisconsin in January to speak with members of the Medical Society of Milwaukee County. The 9th annual African-American film series at UWM features a recent film by an award-winning filmmaker and Milwaukee native, a conversation with George Tillman Jr. when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee native George Tillman Jr. has directed and produced numerous movies, including well-known films such as Soul Food, The Barbershop Series, and Men of Honor. His most recent film, The Inevitable Defeat of Mr. and Pete, was written by another Milwaukee native, Michael Starbury. It tells the story of two young boys forced to fend for themselves one summer in Brooklyn when their mothers are taken away by the authorities. The film will be screened tomorrow at UWM's Union Theater. Back in September, Tillman was honored for his film work by the Milwaukee Film Festival. Shortly before he came back to his hometown, he talked with Lake Effect's Bonnie North from his office in Hollywood and reflected on the movie.
It's a really beautiful, great story. It's a story that you never really see that much in film or on television. It's a story that goes untold. The script came to me around 2009 in February, and when I started reading the script, I fell immediately in love with the material. And then I come to find out that the writer is actually from Milwaukee himself. His name is Michael Starbury. He's a writer that grew up in the Hillside Housing Projects in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that he was now living in Minnesota. So that really sparked my interest to really read the material. But it's this beautiful, beautiful story about two young kids who didn't know each other very well. One is 13 years old, African-American kid, and one is an 8-year-old Asian kid, and their mom abandoned them during the last day of school. And it's really about these two kids who have to become friends, who have to rely on one another to survive a really hot, long summer in the Brooklyn projects in Brooklyn, New York. and they have to survive without any electricity, without any food, and they have to dodge the housing authority police so they don't get put into the system, which could lead to foster or being in juvenile system. So it's really about these two kids who have to survive with one another and their relationships and how we need other people in our lives. And I thought that was just a beautiful story, and I wanted to tell that as a director.
For Mister, who is the older of the two, you know, it's about his dreams and what he thinks he's capable of. And that's often a story we don't hear or see either.
Yes, you know, and the interesting thing is the movie is told through the eyes of this kid. And no matter how many obstacles that is thrown in front of this kid, I mean, these guys have to survive every day. And there's a lot of obstacles that come at them. But they keep moving forward. And sometimes it's a good lesson for us to learn just through kids alone. No matter what things are thrown in front of them, no matter how tough things get, and no matter how bleak things get, sometimes they're not aware of these things. They all are in the moment and thinking about trying to get to the next day. And I thought it was a really great human lesson there, then, that we can learn from children, that we sometimes things get tough. We just have to keep moving on, and we have to go and dig deep within ourselves. And sometimes we need other people to help us get there. And I thought that was just a great human story in how these young kids are able to keep moving.
I loved the relationship between the two of them. The two actors just did such a great job. And am I right in thinking that they didn't have a lot of experience before they were in this film?
Yeah, no, they didn't have a lot of experience. I mean, they have done short films and smaller independent projects. And I was just taken away in the audition rooms by Skylin Brooks, who actually came in to audition the same day that Ethan Design, who plays Pete. They didn't know each other. They were there on the same day. And immediately I brought these two kids together. And one of the things that I learned as a filmmaker years ago when I was working, you know, like in a film like Men of Honor, when I was working with Robert De Niro, is that, you know, your actors is your partners. They're your partners in crime. You have to deal and work with these individuals for, like, the whole entire shoot, and you have to rely on one another and trust one another. And these kids, even though they were 13 and 8 years old at the time, they understood and was passionate about the movie and put every ounce of energy and talent and guts into the movie that they had. And I was blessed to have really tremendous, great kids in this film, and they were my partners throughout the whole project.
The thing that I think struck me as a viewer is that I didn't feel that they were acting.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, and I think that is taking away the words and finding what's underneath and throwing the words out and really doing things through behavior. And I think that's what we learn as human beings, that we are who we are, not what we say, but what the things that we do. And they were able to understand that right off the bat, you know, just going to these particular areas in the projects in Brooklyn and seeing a lot of kids who were left behind by parents, seeing kids who sometimes moms or parents had rehab, had issues with addiction, and they went away for a few days, a few weeks, or they get arrested, they left alone. They're able to have these conversations with these kids, and somehow the kids are able to see the behavior, the human aspects, sometimes because they don't judge. And I think they're able to really hone in on these behaviors and made it the movie feel real.
You talked about having actors as partners. The other thing that I think has been really important in your career is the importance of the script. And you mentioned that Michael Starbury wrote this. Normally, do you write your own scripts or are you open to getting scripts from other people?
I'm very open. I wrote my first two movies, my first independent, and then Soul Food was my second film. Really the first one that had distribution, Soul Food, and I wrote that, and it was based off my experience growing up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. My grandmother lived on 10th and Burlite. Every Sunday we had Sunday dinners, and it was an interesting time how family were close through communication and through dinners and through, you know, keeping the tradition together. So that was a personal story, and I was able to write that personal story. But since then, I haven't did that much writing. I've just been concentrating on directing, so I haven't always been open to reading other people's materials. Also, ironically, Men of Honor was written by Scott Smith, who actually grew up on the east side of Milwaukee. So he actually was a Milwaukee writer himself. So I actually worked with two writers from my same hometown. But just because of my writing skills and what I have done, I'm able to navigate through the material, see things a lot more clearly of what thematically what the story is trying to say. So it's been very helpful. And I'm always open to reading new material and hearing new voices.
I was just talking to a couple of the guys from the Dissolve, the online film journal and criticism venture that's happening out of Chicago. And we were talking about sort of the state of film and the state of criticism. And one of the things they said was that they thought that Hollywood has just been having so much trouble making medium-sized and small movies that something like this wouldn't necessarily get a blockbuster release. Do you find working in the system as you are that it's difficult to get smaller projects? And by smaller, I mean it's relative, you know? I mean, it's not tiny, but it's certainly not a $100 million film.
Yeah, it's really tough. I mean, for this film to really see the light of day, I tried with the studios very early on, and nobody wanted to make the movie because this is, you know, it's a story that, you know, they felt like who would want to see movies about kids who struggle. And I kept saying, you know, this movie is an inspirational film, but at the end of the day, it's not a high concept blockbuster summer movie. And I kept saying that I really feel that people want to see human stories. So everybody passed on the material. So then you have to go out and find the money independently, which we did. And then you have to go through festivals to look for a buyer. And then the buyers are always looking at what is the marketing cost and how much money they will get back. So you're very limited to who will want to buy the film. The great thing about us, we were able to have Lionsgate, Summit, and Cold Black involved, who bought the movie and really wanted to get the film out there. So there's one of us, there's 20, 30 other films that never got to see distribution or have seen it in their very small release. At the end of the day, you know, you just have to keep making films and keep pushing. This year has been a remarkable year because films that they said would never really work, you know, like years ago, Jackie Robinson, 42, it was years in the making before they finally got that off the ground. And then when it comes out, you know, it's number one at the box office. So there's been a lot of cases like that this year. But people are looking for personal stories, and hopefully that will start changing things.
One of the things I think, you know, people hearing this interview, and particularly aspiring filmmakers here, because there's a good film school at UWM, and there's a, you know, an animation program now that's at UWM and at MATC. What particular advice would you give to young filmmakers who are right here and want to go the distance?
I think the key is really finding out what kind of stories that you want to tell and finding out yourself as a filmmaker. And I think an important key is to tell stories that are very important to you and write those stories. I never really considered myself a writer in terms of as a screenwriter. I just felt like I wanted to direct a film, and my only avenue of really doing that was writing. And the best way of writing was writing something that I know. And I really think that's the key, is really getting to the direction of making movies and getting people to see your films. And if you're not a writer, and I just felt like I never felt like I was a writer. I just did it that one time just to open up the doors for me as a director, and it worked out. And another avenue is if you want to make films, is you have so many avenues now. You know, you got digital filmmaking is changing the game, you know, and a lot of people are making films for lower and lower prices and for smaller budgets. And there's more outlets now because of social media. And I think it's very important, if you want to be a filmmaker, make your films. If it's small films, short films, narratives, documentaries. Now we don't have the excuse that it costs a lot of money to print 35 or 16 millimeter film. And all it takes is a good story. And I think that's the best advice I can give anyone. And as a filmmaker now, you constantly should always keep making movies and keep telling stories.
So what's next for you?
There's a couple things on my plate. I'm very excited about something I've been developing for a while, which is the Miles Davis music biopic. Hopefully that can happen in the near future. I'm working on that mostly every day. And I have a couple other projects that I'm pushing as well at studios. So we'll see. I hope the Miles Davis happens very soon. I hope that's the next one up.
Yeah, me too. And I hope you'll talk with us about it once it's released, because I'd love to talk to you about that process.
Oh, great. No problem.
Director-producer George Tillman Jr. spoke with Bonnie North. His latest film, The Inevitable Defeat of Mr. and Pete, will show tomorrow evening at the UWM Union Theater as part of the 9th Annual African-American Film Series at UWM. Tillman spoke with Bonnie North shortly before he was honored at September's Milwaukee Film Festival. Another film, this one 25 years old, inspired a new young adult novel by a Wisconsin native. We'll meet Elizabeth Uhlberg when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Thank you.
guess she's not for me.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Of all the date movies of the past 25 years, the one that may have spurred the most introspective conversations among couples is the 1989 movie When Harry Met Sally. The romantic comedy starred Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan and posed the fairly simple question, can a man and a woman just be friends?
Being secretly attracted to the person you just friend with, which you probably are. I mean, come on, who the hell are we kidding? Let's face it. Which brings us back to the early rule before the amendment, which is men and women can't be friends. So where does it leave us?
Harry, goodbye.
Okay.
A quarter century later, a new young adult novel tries to take on that very same premise. Wisconsin native Elizabeth Uhlberg is the author of Better Off Friends, and she's with us in the Lake Effect studio this morning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this book reads very much like an updated young adult version of When Harry Met Sally, and I gather that is by design?
Yes. When I talked to my editor about what my next book would be, he just said, I was talking to a colleague. He was talking to a colleague of his, and they were talking about how there hasn't really been kind of an updated young adult version of When Harry Met Sally. And I loved that movie so much, about like a guy and a girl, best friend. And so I called dibs on the project. I was working on my last book, which was called Revenge of the Girl with a Great Personality at the time. So I said, just let me think about it. And I purposely didn't watch the movie while I was thinking about how I was going to write this book. And I waited until the very end to watch it. And it was very funny how much of that movie still resonates and how timeless it is, and even the dynamics of the guy and the girl. And I had a lot of inspiration from it. So it's like the highest compliment I could get.
It strikes me that there's the scene, of course, in When Harry Met Sally, where they're remotely watching Casablanca together over the phone. And that movie to those characters is probably as old as When Harry Met Sally is to kids that are in high school now.
So when I've been talking to kids and they ask what my next book is, you know, Better Off Friends is just coming out today. And so I've said, oh, I'm working on this book that is an updated on When Harry Met Sally. And most of them don't know what I'm talking about. And I just feel like, oh, my gosh, you guys have to watch it. And I know that it's so dated with the fashion, but it's still – it's such a timeless story. So I'm hoping, if anything, this will get kids to watch that movie.
And the question at the heart of When Harry Met Sally and at the heart of this book is whether men and women, or in this case, boys and girls, can ever be just friends.
Yes. And it was just really interesting to tackle the relationship, because I wanted to show in high school, guys and girls, they're friends, but I needed to make a few things to have these characters have a connection. And it was very much I wanted the reader to experience them meeting for the first time. And that was something from When Harry Met Sally, is that you see the characters meet, and it's over a period of, I think, about 10 years, that movie. And so I really wanted to explore what's it like when you meet someone when you're not really thinking about romance when you're in seventh grade, and then how it kind of blossoms from there.
Well, and I think it speaks to another issue, that you are writing about these characters in a really formative part of their lives. It's one thing for Harry and Sally to be trying to be friends when they are in their 20s and 30s. But in this case, you're writing about people who are in their teens, and they're just beginning to navigate relationships of all kinds.
Yes, it was really interesting to start writing characters when they were in seventh grade, because usually when I write, my characters are in sophomore, junior year, and you have very different ideas of what friendship is and what, you know, you want out of any kind of relationship when you're in seventh grade. And it was really interesting to see their relationship grow. And one of the reasons why I did these little interstitials in the book, which is from When Harry Met Sally, because that's one of my favorite parts of the movie, is when you see those older couples talk about how they met. And I think there's something very special about listening to a couple just talk and reminisce, because I think it shows how they are towards each other, what their relationship is. And so I wanted to have those little vignettes, especially at the beginning of the book, so people could see what they are like now, because it takes them a while to get very warm to each other. As with any relationship, it isn't an instant, we're now best friends, I tell you all my secrets. It was a very big growth process, because I do think it takes a little while when you're younger to warm up to people.
And we've been referring to them as they. We should mention Levi and McAllen.
Yes, Levi and McAllen.
And the book is written from both the male and female perspectives. Maybe it's an obvious question, but was it harder for you to both appreciate and channel Levi's point of view than it was McAllen's?
It was, because I'm not a boy.
And certainly not a teenage boy.
I'm not a teenage boy. And a lot of being a writer is listening. So I will fully admit that if I'm, you know, in line behind younger boys, I will take my headphones out and listen to how they talk. But I made sure that he sounded a little different than McKellen in just different ways. And a few things I've noticed, and I will talk when I'm around like a 12-year-old boy. I'll be like, so what's going on nowadays? And, you know, I'm not a stalker. I'm a writer. It's called research. But, no, it was, and I had to really make sure that I got him right. And luckily my editor is a guy, so that it helps to make sure that I wasn't having him use any overly flowery language.
I will say, as you know, having once been a teenage boy, you also made perhaps Levi not as stereotypical as we might think. You know, he is a teenage boy, but he is kind of a renaissance teenage boy, if you will. You know, he's certainly a thinker.
He is. And what I like about Levi is he has a really great relationship with his family, and he really just wants to belong. And that's it. He moves from California to Wisconsin, and he just wants to fit in, because he fit in California. He just has a problem in Wisconsin just fitting in. And that is so much of anybody. Everybody just wants to fit in and belong and have friends, especially in school. And I really had that be part of his. He wanted to be part of a team. He just wanted to be a dude, one of the bros. And you know, but he was very thoughtful about it. And I think having McKellen in his life makes him a little bit more thoughtful and aware than he would be if he was just hanging out with the dudes.
And McKellen, we should talk about a little bit as well. You know, she is growing up without an influential figure in her life, and that shapes her personality in a lot of ways.
Yes. McKellen's mother passed away the previous year when you meet her, and it really does affect her a lot what she thinks of what a family is. And when Levi comes into his life and she kind of bonds with his mother, and that is a huge reason why their families become so close, because she doesn't have that. She has a dad and an uncle that they're very close to. But she doesn't have that mother figure. And when you're in seventh grade and eighth grade, you know, you go through things, you just want to have a mother or female influence to kind of guide you through some of the tricky things that happen in life.
It would also be hard to read this book, at least if you are of a certain age, without getting a certain Ross and Rachel vibe to Levi McKellen.
Thank you. I never thought. But of course, I grew up on Friends. Who doesn't love Friends? I love Friends. And I think Ross and Rachel are the perfect example of what happens when you date a really good friend and then when that falls apart too. So, yeah. Thank you.
We aren't going to give too much away, but there's obviously a roller coaster nature to their relationship.
Yeah,
exactly. I guess the other thing it dawned on me, I mean, you grew up in Wisconsin. You have been away for a good long while, but you have set this latest novel here. In fact, it takes place in, I believe it's an unnamed suburb of Milwaukee.
Yeah, it's an unnamed suburb of Milwaukee. I was thinking I was going to have it somewhere specific, but then when you have it somewhere specific, there's just a lot that comes into people saying, that's not what our high school is like. So
where's the Piggly Wiggly?
Yeah, exactly. So it is an unnamed suburb of Milwaukee. And I've never set a book in Wisconsin before. And I just thought, well, I'll do it. And it ended up kind of becoming its own character in a way. It ended up being a bigger part of the book than I thought. But when you grow up somewhere, and I grew up in Portage, you kind of end up not realizing what is so special about where you live until you leave it. So it wasn't until I went to Syracuse University on the East Coast, like out east, that I realized that people don't call water fountain bubblers. I was like, where's the bubbler freshman? And that was my nickname freshman year. So they're like, what's a bubbler? I'm like, you know the thing where you drink water from? And they're like, water fountain? I was like, oh, is that what you call it? Or Friday night fish fries. And I have a group of Wisconsin friends in New York. We call ourselves NYC Cheeseheads. And you know, when we all met each other, we were relative strangers, and we met to watch Packer games. And it's so funny, all the things you have in common and all the things, you know, just talking about cheese curds and Packers. And it's just this pride of being from Wisconsin that a lot of people from other states that I know don't have. So I was really excited to set a book there, and I hope I did it justice.
Well, and it's funny you describe it as almost being like another character in the book. It struck me as I read this that there was something decidedly Midwest about how it plays out, that the kind of friendships and family connections that inhabit the book probably aren't the kind that you would find in a sort of faceless New Jersey suburb, say.
Well, and you know, I write about what my experience is. So when I write about high school, I kind of think about the high school that I went to and my family. And, you know, we had, you know, supper every night together, and, you know, we were a family. And so it's really odd. My last book that I had a family that was broken, and that just wasn't my experience. But so I think a lot of my books do have just a little Midwestern feel, just because I am from the Midwest. And there's just this sense of community and home that I grew up with, especially in my teen years. So I always take from that when I write.
Well, would you say, I mean, is the relationship between Levi and McCallan far different than the kinds of relationships that you have written about before?
Yes. I think that I've written a lot about, you know, female friendship, and there can be a lot of, competitiveness regarding that. I wrote – one of my books, Take a Bow, was about a performing arts high school and about these two best friends who go to a performing arts high school. And with that specific place that you go to school, it's very competitive in how that treats you. And I've never really explored a guy and a girl relationship that wasn't romantic from the start, where it's just – and I feel like they care about each other on a much deeper level, and I've never had – two characters whose families are so close. I really, you know, McCallan, after having this devastating loss of her mother, is searching for her family. And Levi, having moved from California to Wisconsin, is really searching for their home. So they both are kind of looking for the same thing without realizing it.
Well, and you said you know, when you would tell teens that you were writing a book that was inspired by When Harry Met Sally, and they gave you blank stares. Once they get their head around this central question, I mean, this seems like the kind of book that would really pretty easily spur some pretty spirited discussions among your readers.
Yeah, I've already, you know, one of the great things in the past few years is that there's a huge blogger community online of people who love books. And so I've already seen a lot of bloggers who have had advanced copies of the book and read it and talk about this experience. And some of them have said, you know, I had a best friend in high school who's a guy and it didn't influence anything. And then I have some people say you absolutely cannot be friends. So even the debate online has been very interesting. But I'm excited because I'm going to some schools in the area this week and getting to talk to the kids and thinking what – in getting to hear what they have to say.
Okay, so I'll put you on the spot. Can men and women be friends without being involved in a relationship?
So it's funny because I have a handful of guy friends who I'm very, very close with who are like my best friends, but they're all gay. So we always joke about like, well, but it doesn't get in the way. So it's not an issue. I do have a really good guy friend from high school who's now in San Francisco, and I see him every once in a while. And I always made him uncomfortable. I'm like, well, I'm writing about this guy and a girl best friend, and it's based on our experiences in Portage. And he would just kind of roll his eyes. But I did, when we first met freshman year, I did have a crush on him. But then we became really good friends, and he was kind of almost like a brother to me. So it was just kind of this joke of like, oh, I wouldn't want to date you now. But yeah, I do think it's always in the back of the mind. But I don't have – and all of my straight guy friends are either like the boyfriends or husbands of my friends. So,
well, it is a warm and funny read, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. Elizabeth Eulberg, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Portage, Wisconsin native Elizabeth Eulberg's latest book is the young adult novel Better Off Friends, which is just out today and set in an unnamed Milwaukee suburb. Eulberg lives in New York. The book's launch is tonight at Boswell Book Company. She'll also read tomorrow evening at Books & Company in Oconomowoc. That's Tuesday's show. Tomorrow, when the study of race in this country turned into the study of race and crime, it goes back longer than you might realize. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
It had to be you. I wandered around.